Well, good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. That snippet opening tonight's show was from the song Breath of Passion from one of my favorite artists here on the show, hailing from Las Vegas, called Zingaya. I don't know about you, but that song in particular, it just automatically transports me. I feel like I'm on the back of a camel with that loping gait, walking across the sands of some desert somewhere in time. Anyway, it's still Women's History Month. We still have a few days left to celebrate and use it to help educate. I wonder if you saw former President Jimmy Carter on the David Letterman show this week. Well, I have to tell you, I was applauding him, as I do often. He was there talking about his new book called Call to Action, and he talked to David about important women's issues and how it is just unbelievable that this discrimination and exploitation of women goes unchecked across the globe and untalked about. You know, he actually, right there on the David Letterman show, talked about female genital mutilation in stark detail. He mentioned how girls are cut to remove the pleasure centers of their sex organs, then sewn up again, only leaving a small opening that they can urinate from, that their that their menses can pass and flow through, only to be reopened to have sex when they get married and to have babies. You know, I bet that just blew a bunch of minds across his viewing audience. I bet it was the first time a lot of people listening to television had ever heard of female genital mutilation. And, you know, he made it really clear. This stuff was not just in third world countries. He talked about it happening here. He talked about how Atlanta, Georgia, is a hub for human sex trafficking, particularly of women, how rape is being used as a weapon of war, and how our military and on college campuses are the places where women suffer some of the most assaults and rapes. Why? Well, because college presidents and military brass don't want to admit it's happening on their watch, so it goes unreported. You know, it was a great interview, and I'm so glad I caught it. I hope you did, too. I ordered his book, Call to Action, and I'm sure there are lots of facts in there that we can use to continue to educate low-information masses out there. And speaking of books, I have to plug my new book again. The publisher requires it. Goddess Calling is out now. It came out this month, and Amazon has it for sale at a discount price of $12 and a bit of change. I hope you'll go online and purchase it. It's also in ebook format. And please write a review. I still don't have anyone reviewing it yet on Goodreads. I could use some great reviews, and I'll tell you a little secret. I did get one bad review so far, and I confess the viewer obviously did not understand the importance of reconciling your spirituality and politics. Poor woman sounded like she was straight off Fox News. And I guess it's to be expected, just like when people don't understand when I say it's hard to reconcile being a Republican today and a goddess advocate. You know, these are values very much opposed to each other, and me and my guests have talked about that a lot. So if you see any reviews out there like that, I hope you'll take the reviewer to task and support women's rights and the rights of Mother Earth, and take a stand that you cannot be a goddess advocate and simultaneously support a political party that damages women's rights and poisons our beloved Gaia. And if you want to hear some of the interviews I've been doing about my book, Goddess Calling, please check out my Facebook pages, and pretty soon they'll also be up on my website. My webmistress is updating things this week. There are links to several of the interviews I've been doing on numerous radio stations. Earlier today, I did a conference call for women in for the Women in Business World Summit, talking about goddess ideals in business for a fair, more just, and equal society. And speaking of which, have you seen the ads on television from Republicans using women to say, women are just too busy to worry about equal pay? Talk about women complicit in their own oppression. Unbelievable. Truly, truly. So anyway, keep up the great work buying my book. And thanks to Pat, one of my listeners, for the book order that came in. And you purchased one directly from me so you could get a signed copy. And thanks for the donation to the radio show as well. You are gas in my tank, Pat, and I love you. And if you're listening, the chat room is open. And if you'd like to call in, the number is 718-766-4662. If we get a chance, we will get to you. And later on tonight, in my What's the Buzz segment, I'm going to share an article called Let's Make Capitalism a Dirty Word. You won't want to miss it. And just some quick shout-outs before I get to tonight's first guest. I want to say thank you to Dawn. I'm going to just say the initial of her last name, Dawn T. She sent me a note. She said, you have a faithful listener here in Kuwait. Karen, your show has changed my life. Never stop. Give me a few months and I have a gift for you. Much love, Dawn T. And that's from Kuwait. Thank you, Dawn. I so appreciate you reaching out. Also, Claudine sent me an email today, and she wanted to bring to my attention the short video to Women of Vision, which features photojournalism from a woman's perspective. And you can see it yourself. I highly recommend you do. It's really lovely, and I thank Claudine for thinking of me, and I want to share it with all of you listeners. If you just go to the website elevate.us, elevate.us, and you put in probably Brave Photographers, women's photojournalism, I think it will definitely come up because the whole point of the article is what's been missing in the world of photojournalism is a woman's perspective, and you see lots of great photojournalism from women. Just what we need, most definitely. So, one more thing. I wanted to share with you something that another listener brought to my attention on my Facebook page. It's by Eve Ensler and Tony Strobel. And just real quick, it's really beautiful. It's called, I think it's The Man's Prayer. And it says, may I be a man who understands vulnerability is my greatest gift. May I be a man whose confidence comes from the depth of my giving, who understands that vulnerability is my greatest strength, who creates space rather than dominates it, who appreciates listening more than knowing, who seeks kindness over control, who cries when the grief is too much, who refuses the slap, the gun, the choke, the insult, the punch. May I not be afraid to get lost. May I cherish touch more than performance and the experience more than getting there. May I move slowly, not abruptly. May I be brave enough to share my fear and shame and gather the other men to do the same. May I stop pretending and open the parts of me that have long been numb. May I cherish, respect, and love my mother. May the resonance of that love translate into loving all women and living things. This is really beautiful, and they've put it to YouTube, so it's not just beautiful words, but it's beautiful men saying these beautiful words. I'm sure you can find it easily. Just Google or go on YouTube, Eve Ensler's Man's Prayer, and you will most definitely find it. And please share it. Share it everywhere. Share it, share it, share it. Okay, turning my attention to tonight's show. I am so glad to have Saffron Rossi, PhD, on the show with me, a scholar whose writing and studies focus on archetypal psychology, Western astrological tradition, goddess traditions, and feminist studies. Our topic tonight is Joseph Campbell in Goddess Mythology, because Dr. Rossi edited Joseph Campbell's new book, Goddesses. Campbell's first book focused on goddess mythology. And then second up, later on in the show, is Diane Collins, author of Do You Quantum Think? new thinking that will rock your world. We will find out just what quantum thinking is all about and how we can create better lives using this method of thinking. We'll talk about allowing, intent, infinite possibility, among other things, including how to maintain peace of mind in chaotic and uncertain times. But first, you know I have to pay for the show. So a word from Joe Carson and Dancing with Gaia, which helps me keep Voices of the Sacred Feminine on the air.
Most people's psychic experiences are dreaming, and it's thought that it's the pineal gland making this chemical that does it. Now, this was the core finding that the pineal gland makes a hallucinogen. We all hallucinate, we all go into a state of consciousness that for me is the collective unconscious. This psychic state is the collective unconscious, which is that consciousness of the planet, what's called the cosmic mind, the mind of the earth. Because all peoples, all races, all tribes from the past and right around the world have myths and legends which use symbols and archetypes which are identical. Identical. Every human being experiences this state of consciousness, which is the dream mind. That symbolic, archetypal, exemplified by fairy tales, or the creation myths and legends of all the different peoples. The symbols of them are the same, and to me that is the consciousness of the earth speaking to us.
Well, that was Serena Roney Dougal, PhD, speaking in Joe Carson's film, Dancing with Gaia. Dancing with Gaia explores the connection between earth energy, sacred sexuality, and the goddess as Gaia. It features 15 visionaries like Roney Dougal, who gives us tools to feel the life of the planet within ourselves. And the DVD comes with a 45-page book, and all of that is just $20. You can get your own copy at dancingwithgaia.com, and I can wholly recommend it. I think it is a must for your library. And speaking of Joe and her commercials that help keep Voices of the Sacred Feminine on the air, if you like what you're hearing and you want to ensure the show keeps on the airwaves here at Blog Talk, please go to my website, KarenTate.com. Once you're there, go to my Goddess Store page, scroll down to the PayPal buttons, and make a donation of any amount, because you know what? It all adds up, $5 here, $5 there. And thank you, thank you, thank you for your donations, for your kind emails. That let me know what I'm doing is making a difference. And you know what? While you're there, please take advantage of the free meditations on the Goddess Store page. There's also some, besides the great spring meditations, right there on the Goddess Store page, you can find links to other great information, lots of interviews where I've been interviewed myself talking about the importance of the sacred feminine as deity, archetype, and ideal. And it's a great resource, really. So enjoy yourself. Look around. Take advantage of everything there that's free. And with all of that housekeeping out of the way, it's time to get to my first guest, Saffron Rossi. I want to welcome her to the show. And Saffron, thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Karen.
Well, let's start by letting me introduce you by way of your bio, and then we'll jump in and talk about this wonderful book that I'm so excited to know is out there now. So listeners, Saffron Rossi, PhD, is a scholar whose writing and studies focus on archetypal psychology, the Western astrological tradition, as well as goddess traditions and feminist studies. She is associate core faculty at Pacifica Graduate Institute in the Depth Psychology Union and Archetypal Studies Program, where she studies, where she teaches courses on mythology and depth psychology. She's also a curator of collections at Opus Archives and Research Center, home of the Joseph Campbell Library and Manuscript Collection. She was raised in a family of artists that read Jung and Joseph Campbell, and she spent her life steeped in literature, religion, and mythology, fields in which she holds her degrees. So if you were such a fan, I bet you were just thrilled to be the one chosen to edit this book. Am I right?
Yes. It was a huge honor when the president of the Joseph Campbell Foundation talked with me about this idea, because the idea of a volume in the Campbell Collected Works being published that focused on Campbell's goddess work had been something that they had been holding for quite a long time, actually. So it was really amazing that it hadn't been done before me, and that the topic, my studies, the timing, everything ended up being a match, and the work actually came to be. So, yes, so, it was a very exciting thing.
So, Saffron, is there any particular reason why in his lifetime he didn't get around to doing the book on goddesses?
Well, I don't think there's any clear-cut reason. I mean, you know, those of your listeners who have read a lot of Campbell know that in a lot of his books there are significant sections that look at particular mythologies and figures that are a part of the whole goddess, let's say, mythological matrix, symbolic matrix. So that is present throughout his work. Now, why there hadn't been a single volume akin to The Hero with a Thousand Faces, let's say, published on the goddess myths, I don't know, and Joe isn't around for us to ask him. But the story goes that while he was alive, one of his colleagues had been interested in getting this volume together, and for one reason or another, the manuscript didn't quite take a shape that Campbell felt like he could really get his hands around. And then a few years after he had died, a woman who had been a student of his had also wanted to give the topic a go, and the same thing happened where the manuscript's form and shape just didn't quite gel, and that was in the 80s. And so a couple decades later, the timing was just right. You know, a lot of, you know how it is with creative work. There are a lot of forces that kind of come into play, and either they converge or they don't. And for some reason, this third time around, it seems to really come together.
Well, that's great. The third time was a charm. Well, I do want to get. Well, I do want to get into your methodology and what mythologies he focused on, but I'd really be remiss, with so many of my listeners being Maria Gimbutas fans, to not ask you this. I know Joseph Campbell said that Maria Gimbutas's work, you know, he considered it a Rosetta Stone. I'm curious if this book will help support her work at all. You know, considering how controversial it is, how she's still demeaned out there, unfortunately, by, you know, what we call patriarchal academia. Does this help her her theories at all?
Yeah, great question. Thank you for asking it, because, in fact, at Opus Archives, where Joseph Campbell's collection is, where I curate, we also have Maria Gimbutas's collection. So it's really this remarkable place where some of the most radical, revolutionary, and important ideas in the fields of mythology kind of live, and whose legacies are just waiting to be accessed and sort of taken to another level. So I just wanted to put that piece in there, because I think another one of the reasons why this book finally came together now is that the amount of time that I've spent studying Campbell, you know, these last 8 years, I've become really close with Maria's work as well. And as anyone who goes to this book will see, the absolute foundation of the book, of Campbell's lectures, rests upon Maria's groundbreaking work on the Neolithic Old Europe goddess cultural system. And Campbell said, and also in the book, we have Campbell's foreword to Maria's The Language of the Goddess, which he wrote and was published right after he died. But as Campbell said, all these years that he had been studying mythology, he was able to start to track the symbolic themes and the functions and the figures through culture, starting at around, you know, the Bronze Age and whatnot. But the moment he got to Maria Gimbutas's work, he was basically given the entire substructure, the most foundational level of the mythological cultural imagination that we could come to. And it completely grounded what he was intuiting regarding the development of the feminine divine through culture. So I think for people who, you know, might be trying to understand the way that the feminine divine has unfolded and come into various forms, Maria's work is obviously absolutely central. Without it, we're still, you know, within 3,000 years of human culture. By bringing Maria in, we're going back 10,000 years. So it's really, really critical. So I think from that mythological humanities mythopoetic perspective, Maria's work really gets honored in a way that maybe people might not get to her because she was such an archaeologist and really, you know, deeply a part of that field. People don't always make inroads to the interdisciplinary pieces that we need in order to understand the development of the mythic imagination. So I hope that the people that are drawn to this book, that Maria becomes a real new find for them, and that they're inspired by her absolutely incredible work.
Well, you know, I'm convinced that this sort of stuff that we talked about sort of puts us in the cognitive minority, you know, and we're just waiting for the rest of the world to catch up.
I agree with you.
I really have faith and a confidence, a certainty that, you know, maybe it's going to be 20 years from now, 30 years from now, but I think when the sacred feminine really hits full stride and it's becoming more and more of a mainstream idea, you know, whether we're talking deity, archetype, or ideal, it is becoming more of a mainstream idea. I truly believe that. And I think as it does, her work, you know, it just all becomes, you know, part and parcel. You know, it's all hand in glove. And I can't wait for the day that, you know, she's really given the credit she finally deserves. And, you know, all of these naysayers will finally, you know, maybe see the light, so to speak, if they ever will.
You know, one of her students a few years back had given me a couple of audio recordings for the archives. One of them was the lecture she gave at the book launch in L.A. for Language of the Goddess. So this was, I think, the year she died or maybe the year before Gimbutas died. And in her lecture, you know, she's thanking everyone for supporting the book, and she's talking about the main thrust of the book, Language of the Goddess. And she says, it won't be for another 50 years before people really start understanding the significance of the Neolithic Old Europe goddess culture, the work that I've been doing. So I think you're right when you say 20, 30 years, because she died in the early 90s, we're right at that marker point. We're getting there that Maria herself thought would be when, you know, her work could really be understood on a whole nother level. We'll get there. I know my optimist self says we will.
And, you know, and I'm glad to hear you say that, because I wasn't aware she thought that. You know, it makes me feel really good, because I can't think of anything worse than her having left us you know, under that cloud, you know, that, you know, of being so unfairly treated by academia. But I'm so glad she really knew in her heart of hearts it was just a matter of time and should be vindicated, and, you know, her work would be accepted. So that thank you for sharing that. Well, let's get to, you know, the book Goddesses, which you, you know, put your heart and soul in here to edit. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how, you know, your methodology, how did it come into shape?
Right. So what I was given was basically 16 years worth of audio lectures that Campbell had been delivering all around the country between 1972 and roughly 1986. And how I began was simply just listening to these audio lectures. Some of them were one afternoon presentations. For example, an alumni lecture at Sarah Lawrence, where, as you know, he had been a professor. Some of them were multi-day seminars up at Esalen or at La Casa de Maria here in Santa Barbara. And so I just began to immerse myself in his style of presentation, but also the way that he was tracking and unfolding the development and the transformations of the feminine divine figure through many different cultures, starting from the Paleolithic all the way to the Neoplatonic Renaissance. And in steeping myself in his way of unfolding all of that, my intent was to stay very close to the inherent structure of his own thought and methodology. And so after listening, beginning to sketch out the various sections and the flow of the sections, I then had the lectures transcribed so that I then had a text. And all of the various versions, let's say, of his, you know, Neolithic lecture, I started to weave together into one so that there was the most information, the most fleshed out and complete version of all we had of his ideas on, let's say, the Neolithic culture in Gimbutas's work. So, because you can imagine that in one lecture he would tell one story, and then maybe the next time he wouldn't tell that same story but a different one, or give a slightly different twist on something. So there were lots of versions of the same ideas that I wanted to make as three-dimensional as possible. So that, in essence, was really the process.
I bet that was time-consuming. I bet it was pretty time-consuming.
Yeah, it was about a two-year project. Yeah, so it definitely was a commitment, but it was a phenomenal experience.
So what mythologies did he tend to focus on, or what archetypal energies did he see as central to goddess mythology across the cultures?
Well, given how central Maria Gimbutas's work was, you know, to his understanding of this particular, let's say, archetypal constellation, the book focuses really on the area that would be the Southeast European and the Near East, which he identifies as one of three of the original agricultural zones of development. So what we see in the book is his moving from the Paleolithic France and Spain into the Maria Gimbutas's old Europe Neolithic era, Sumerian and Egyptian mythology. He addresses the Indo-European influx as well as the rising of the Semitic tribes through the Near East. So we watch the transformation of the cultures in Southeast Europe as well as in the Near East. And then he goes into ancient classical Greece. He talks about the Iliad with a particular focus on the Odyssey, which happens to be my favorite chapter in the book. Then a focus on the Eleusinian mystery cult of classical Greece, Dionysian mysteries, and then takes a little bit of a leap and then moves over to the Arthurian romances during the troubadour period in France, and then he talks a little bit about the Neoplatonic Renaissance in Italy. So he really stays in the European complex.
Okay.
In this particular book, yeah.
Okay. And what are some of the main goddess symbolism that maybe he brings out that you focused on?
One of the major themes is the heavenly luminaries. So the way that the sun and the moon has moved through cultures and their associations between the feminine, the eternal, the fire of the creative womb, and then the moon as being the temporal, the masculine, that which is born and then dies into the sun. So the sun and the moon are very significant themes in the book that he tracks. There's also the serpent, of course. And so, the book has over 200 images because Campbell's lectures were slide lectures. So the images are absolutely central. So we have the gorgeous Minoan snake goddess. And so seeing, that seven-tiered dress, the woman, the goddess holding the two snakes with the little leopard or lion sitting on her head, that's kind of one of the symbolic hot images that have a lot to do with the themes that he focused on. Of course, there's also the images of the giving of birth, as we see repeated from the excavations at Chapal Hayuk. So the great, beautiful, fecund, creative body of the female in its birth-giving capacity. How do we understand that biologically? How do we understand that metaphorically? And in that way, Campbell really holds how the central matrix of the goddess works on two levels. The first level being the biological, meaning that we are brought into life through the body of the mother. And we come into life through the mother. We are nourished in life through the mother. The whole cosmos can be understood as this nurturing, sustaining mother body. There we're really moving into the Neolithic mythological understanding. But Campbell says there's a shift that then happens when we look at the mythologies, that once the transformation from Paleolithic hunting to Neolithic, which was agricultural, once that was settled, and then there was the further shift where the human cultural relationship to just kind of being in some sort of understanding with the natural world and the development of food, we start to come into these greater spiritual questions. So where the goddess was initially about physical nurturance, physical sustenance, the mystery of just coming into life, something takes shape during the classical Greek era, he initially puts it. And that is the question of the second birth or the spiritual birth. And that's where he moves into the goddess as being she that initiates us into spiritual meaning and mystery. And that's where we look at the myth of Demeter and Persephone and the Eleusinian mystery cult, which had to do with helping people eradicate their fear of death and really embracing, for as far as we can understand from what's left of us, of accounts regarding the Eleusinian mysteries, regarding a greater consciousness to the never-ending connectivity of life through the generations. So how do we let go of the fear of the now and live into the cosmic eternal? So Campbell says the goddess then becomes she that initiates us into that side, the psychological, spiritual second birth that, happens at, for different cultures, different peoples at different times. But we see this, through human history. We have our first physical birth, and then hopefully our culture supports a second spiritual, psychological birth.
Okay. Well, I'm wondering if you get into in the book, does he offer theories on how we lost the goddess? How does she disappear and patriarchy begins to take hold?
Yeah, he does. We do spend some time, as I mentioned, tracking the Indo-European influx from the Kurgans and the northern Russian steppes coming down and really altering the Neolithic mythic culture. And then he also talks about the Semitic tribes rising up from kind of the southeast into the Near East and really shifting that zone as well. So what Campbell says is that despite the 2,000 years of patriarchal, monotheistic, religious repression of the feminine principle in these particular mythologies, she is still present. And that's where he goes, not present as in just hiding in the corner, but that we have to get a little bit more savvy in terms of reading the stories, recognizing where she's hiding, where she's been hidden in the narratives themselves, in the symbols themselves. But he says it's no doubt that the feminine was completely repressed in Judaism and Christianity. And yet, when the cultural systems started to gain a little bit of flexibility, so to speak, around the religious systems, what do we see but is the rising again of the feminine principle? And he really shows that in the book, particularly in the Greek tradition, in the movement between the culture that gave rise to the Iliad and then the culture that was rising that then brought the Odyssey, the epic poem, the Odyssey to bear, you know, to fruit. So he really shows it in those places, but he doesn't go into great detail regarding the Old Testament or the New Testament and any of that, but he does talk about the extreme shift of the mythic systems that we saw at the time of 3000 BCE when, you know, the Neolithic culture had really started to give way to something entirely different.
Okay. So let me ask you, you know, goddess scholarship has, you know, has really sort of expanded and, you know, we've made strides since his time. Does the book offer any new revelations?
I think the most exciting and fresh piece of Campbell's in this book, because I agree with you, and I address this in the foreword, you know, saying that 30 years have passed and the goddess scholarship has been moved, you know, yards and yards, leagues, you know, by incredibly brilliant women and men who wanted, you know, who really deepen this field. But, you know, that being said, I think Campbell's take on the Odyssey is probably the most interesting and fresh contribution to the whole field of goddess studies that this book has to offer, absolutely.
Well, did you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, so what's so fantastic about his read on the Odyssey is that he says that, you know, with the Iliad, what we have is the beginning of the Trojan War, and what we can see from a cultural standpoint is that the masculine principle has really come to dominate. And so the Iliad is all about property. It's about women as property. It's about dominance and aggression. It's a very martial, cultural and mythic constellation. But then what follows from the Iliad, tracking Odysseus, one of the great heroes from the Trojan War, is this amazing story that shows this masculine warrior trying to get home, and he can't get home, and he has to find himself in relationship with these various nymphs on his way home. What is going on with this story? And Campbell, somewhat drawing on the work of Jane Ellen Harrison, one of those great British classicists from the 19th century, he says, you know, there's something else happening in this story. And he says, if we look at the beginning of the Iliad, where Paris has to choose between Athena, Hera, and Aphrodite, the fact that a mortal is choosing one of three goddesses on some level is already showing us that something has gone on in the culture in terms of the awesomeness or the human experience of the feminine principle. Something's happened that's shifting if a mortal can choose one as opposed to being chosen. So he says, already we see something going on here. But he says, ultimately what we can see is that those three goddesses were insulted by having to be in a competition and to be chosen by one mortal. So he says, if we look at the Odyssey and we look at the three nymphs that Odysseus encounters on his long trials of trying to get home, it is rather Odysseus making amends and being reinitiated into proper relationship with the feminine after his time in this masculine martial field of the Iliad and healing the wound that was caused by Paris. So, Circe, being the first nymph that Odysseus meets, Circe as the avatar of Aphrodite, she's the seductress, she's the sorceress, but through time with her, Odysseus is initiated into the mysteries of the underworld, and he's initiated into the mysteries of the Isle of the Sun of Eternity. After he leaves Circe, he meets Calypso, and he's with Calypso for, what, 7 years? That is marriage. That's partnership. That's man and woman as equal. So that's the domain of Hera, the one of power and as the wife. And then after Odysseus is with Hera, he ends up on the island of Nausicaa and her father, who is a king. Of course, this is where Odysseus is really, we're brought to the present, and he's telling his story. But Nausicaa falls in love with Odysseus because she's in love with the hero. And so she worships him from a very innocent, not intimate or amorous way. And Campbell reached Nausicaa as the avatar of Athena. And he says, so basically, through Circe, Calypso, and Nausicaa, which would be Aphrodite, Hera, and then Athena, Odysseus is reinitiating into proper relationship with the feminine, learning how to be with women not as booty, not as property, but as equals who have their own mysteries and their own ways of teaching, just as men do. And in this way, he's making amends for what had started at the beginning of the Iliad with Paris and being prepared to be reunited with his wife so that he arrives home being capable of being in right relationship to the woman with whom he is an equal and who has been waiting for him just as he's been trying to get back to be with her.
Wow.
Yeah, so to me, that is really a fresh, exciting way of looking at a story that I think is very easy to say, he's Penelope's home being faithful and having to ward off all these men, and there goes Odysseus tripping off and having all of these affairs and, lovers. And, it's very easy to read it that way, but I think Campbell is bringing something else into play. And I just think it's really awesome.
I do too. I think that's really insightful, and I can't wait until that version of the myth is what's taught in classrooms across the country.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of the hero, I know Campbell has always focused on the hero's journey. You having said that, do you think this maybe sort of offers a counterpoint?
Well, Campbell's definition of the hero's journey, I think, is actually a lot more broad than was picked up by popular culture. Because for Campbell, the hero's journey is every individual's journey in coming into their individuality, coming into their uniqueness, being able to turn away from the collective shoulds, the collective idea of who you should be and how you should be, and having the courage and the curiosity and the tenacity to find out who you are as your own unique individual self. Very much akin to Carl Jung's concept of individuation. So for Campbell, that was what the hero's journey is about. It's about being fully in the first birth, which is our physical life, and then really coming into your second birth, your spiritual psychological birth. But that's the hero's journey.
In other words, finding is another way to say it, maybe finding your authentic self?
Exactly. Absolutely. that is it. As he would say, you know, follow your bliss. And your bliss is often also your blisters. It's not just where you're, you know, blissed out. It's also where you meet your edge. It's where you are most authentically yourself, and you can sink into the truth of what, the truth of your being, you yourself, as opposed to what, you know, the culture or the family or the intellect is telling you you should be. So, so if we can take that much more broad definition of the hero's journey, I don't think this book is a counterpoint to it. I think it's a further deepening, because this book really, by looking at the goddess symbols and these mythologies, it has everything to do with that second birth. It has everything to do with that uniqueness of spirit, which we are born with, but it's about becoming conscious of and articulating and refusing to ever let go of, once we've got our heart and our soul and our spirit imbued with clarity as to what that is. And right. I think that's what the goddess mythology is about. And I think that's what he was seeing, was that the feminine principle on some level has to do with initiating us into the surrender of what we think how things should be, and the transformation of our very nature into a second, deeper spiritual, psychological understanding of life.
I totally agree with that. You know, and this just may be my sort of warped interpretation, you know, my theology, so to speak. But, you know, it's felt to me that the sacred feminine more allows us to be our authentic self than the patriarchal authoritarian father that demands this obedience, that we have to fulfill these role models, you know, and fit into these little boxes.
Yeah, I agree with you. And equally, what suffers in the patriarchal structure is also the sacred masculine. Because the sacred masculine isn't about power over, and it isn't about collective norms. It's really about, you know, action in service to creativity and spirit and the potential. And that suffers too under patriarchal structures. So
yeah,
we're
it's important to actually punctuate that, you know, that the sacred masculine is different than maybe the Abrahamic authoritarian father as well.
Oh yes, patriarchy is its own thing. Yeah.
Right.
Separate from the masculine principle, absolutely.
Because I think sometimes even, you know, those of us in goddess spirituality, when we hear sacred masculine, sometimes it's equated in error with maybe the Abrahamic, that God, you know, as
right.
opposed, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So going back to, you know, we said a moment ago that from that audio tape you listened to, you know, Gambutis had a certainty that, you know, her work would be vindicated. I wonder, did you get a sense that maybe Joseph Campbell could foresee, maybe a paradigm shift in the future as well, you know, where the sacred feminine would once again, have its rightful place, or at least, the world would be more aware of it, and it would be useful to society once again?
Yeah, and that's actually a part of one of the last sections of the book that's subtitled Liftoff. And it's this really beautiful section which comes from that alumni lecture that he gave at Sarah Lawrence back in the 70s, where he says, you know, the world is really seeing something now that we haven't had the opportunity to see, which is the freedom for women to not be bound back by their nature roles, i.e. childbearing and children raising and, you know, being still kind of kept in the house. You know, he's talking about feminism, second wave feminism, and all of the radical changes that were going on at the time. And he says, what we're seeing is the potential for women to move into their own creative, unique individuality, which was something that men have had access to all along, and finally women are having the freedom to be able to fully experience. And he says, so what we're seeing now and what we're going to watch unfold, both for women as human people, but also for the feminine principle, which is archetypal and therefore available to men and women, is a whole new articulation, a whole new, let's say, like creative zeitgeist, a time of exploration and questioning and definition. And it's time for the women to tell us what is meaningful to them, to tell us what these stories are about. It's a really moving passage from him where he's, I mean, I get, you know, I actually tear up almost every time I read that section of his, because the image I get is of him standing behind this huge group of women and just supporting them, wanting to hear what they have to say about their mythic spiritual journey and what these great classics, these great mythologies mean to them, because it's time for our voices to be heard. It's really one of the most important parts of the book for me.
Oh, wow.
And I think it was really important for all of us that are in this field of study to hear him speak that way, because I think he gets a little boxed in, too, by being just into the hero's journey and the male and all of that, and that wasn't true. And so it was important to me that people would get a chance to hear in his own words how much he honored the feminine and women and their own journeys to creative, individual life.
Well, and it's so, and I can't wait to read that section myself, because I mean, that's one of the things that I've just felt intuitively, you know, as the sacred feminine comes more to the center, and, you know, we have to decide as women what we're going to do with that, how we're going to interpret it, you know, what is it going to mean to our lives? And, you know, give ourselves permission to do that and not be discouraged or thwarted in any way, you know, to really let our voices, you know, be heard and understand that, you know, maybe there's no right or wrong, you know, because now it's our turn to write the story. And, I mean, patriarchy's written the story for how long? And does anybody really question them? You know, they've set themselves up as the definitive authority. Well, you know, I think we have to have that sort of courage and strength and tenacity to do the very same thing and say, pshaw, you know, if patriarchy says to us, you know, you crazy women, you know, you know, we don't want to hear your voice. You know, I think we really have to take on that mantle of leadership and be courageous and share our insights, you know, and, you know, just see where it takes us.
I agree.
So aside from that, and that's important in itself, any other reasons why the book and the topic is important beyond what we've already talked about, Saffron?
No, I mean, I think the last piece that you said is really the most, I mean, it's a huge piece of it too, which is we're still in this, you know, process of coming into a more sophisticated but also grounded, authentic understanding of feminine and masculine principles and how that's different from being men and women, and how do we make sense of it and how do we live those energies authentically and as consciously as possible. And I think, you know, this book comes out now in support of that. That's my sense, that this is in support of our making greater space for the feminine divine to come in through our individual lives and through our collective lives. So I think that's one of the most important pieces.
Great. Well, I know you have to leave us at 7. I think we have just a couple more minutes. Did you want to tell us about the Campbell Archive manuscript collection at Opus and Pacifica to close our interview?
Yeah, so the best thing that people can do if they're curious about the archives, which are the manuscript collections, as well as Campbell's library, is to visit our website, because we have photographs and descriptions of the collections, will give people a little video so they can do almost like a little virtual tour with me as a guide. So they can do that by visiting opusarchives.org. And Opus is the Latin word for work, opusarchives.org. So there we've got information about the Campbell Collection, Maria Gimbutas, as well as James Hillman and Marion Woodman. So we have 9 major collections. So I just welcome people to check out our website, sign up for our email list, and see what we're doing in terms of tending to the legacy of the ancestors in our field.
Okay. And you mentioned the websites. Did you want to say what those websites are?
Yes. So opusarchives.org, and then Pacifica Graduate Institute can be found at pacifica.edu.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so very much for being on the show tonight. I really enjoyed the conversation with you, and I'm so glad things finally came together so that we have this book, not just for all of us, but for Maria, for Joseph, and, you know, the world that's going to benefit from this remarkable book. Thank you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me, Karen. I really appreciate it.
Oh, anytime. And if you'd ever like to come back on with another topic, you know how to find me. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Good night. Well, listeners, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. There's another book that has to go in the library. So, anyway, I think you'll probably recognize this sound. Yes, we are crossing the threshold into the second part of the show. And just a reminder, I hope you'll stay tuned after I'm finished chatting with my next guest, Diane Collins. Stay tuned for my What's the Buzz segment tonight. I'll be discussing the article on the Op-Ed News website called Let's Make Capitalism a Dirty Word. So, I want to welcome Diane Collins to the show. Diane, I believe that's you there with me on the switchboard.
It is I, and I am so pleased to be here with you. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, Diane, it's my pleasure to have you as well. Let me share with listeners a little bit about your background, and then we're going to start talking about what in the world this quantum think is all about. How does that sound?
That sounds good. And of course, I've been listening to some of your shows, and I didn't hear this show from the beginning, but just the last maybe 20 minutes of it. And of course, I'm thinking about quantum thinking in the context of the sacred feminine. So I look forward to chatting about that with you.
Okay, sounds like juicy stuff. Okay, so listeners, Diane Collins, she's a modern visionary, an original thinker, an authority in the new world view thinking, and the creator of the quantum think system of thinking, an unprecedented body of knowledge based in the principles of quantum science and universal laws applied as practical wisdom in all areas of life. She's the author of Do You Quantum Think? New Thinking That Will Rock Your World, which is what we're talking about tonight, a best-selling book, which delineates this new system of thinking. She's a popular media guest and speaker. She's been interviewed on more than 200 radio and TV shows. She was the keynote at the International Anagram Association, featured speaker at a special event hosted in her honor by the University of Miami Alumni Association, and she was invited to present in the prestigious lecture series of Florida's International University Program in the Study of Spirituality, along with distinguished speakers, including His Holiness the Dalai Lama. With her husband and business partner, Alan Collins, she consults visionary leaders and senior executives in the world's leading corporations to go beyond hidden limits of their thinking, accelerating results and catapulting nonlinear achievements. Clients have included Accenture, AT&T, CNN, DuPont, McKinsey, and agencies of the U.S. government, as well as entrepreneurs and politicos, homemakers and students, celebrities, and evolutionaries worldwide. Well, this sounds like some powerful stuff. sounds like something we all need to shift us into this next paradigm we all keep talking and dreaming about. You know, we think it's going to be this utopia, but it feels like there's so much dead weight we're trying to drag with us. You know, people who just won't get with the program and vibrate at a higher level and even have critical thinking, much less quantum thinking. So, Diane, what do we do?
That's the big question, right? Yes, I was told, I got the silent tap on the shoulder, you would say, from divinity spirit and said, get this out. And you know what I discovered, Karen, is that, which I call my revelation, is that though we imagine we think freely, that we all like to think of ourselves as independent thinkers, and certainly we have in every moment the capability, the ability to choose what we're thinking. In fact, the discovery I made is that our thinking is based in the assumptions, the beliefs, the notions about the nature of reality, about the world and how it works, about women and the feminine principle. And what does that mean is that it's like this. We're in a quantum age, yet our thinking, even for those of us on a conscious path who have an intent to stay in the higher vibrational frequencies, what you're mentioning, even those of us are still very much under the influence of the old conditioning, which really is conditioned to a fixed reality that revolves around matter. The science declared matter is the only thing that's real, physical matter, so are oriented around the five senses, trying to line up all the circumstances before we make a decision, trying to figure out the how-to step somewhere. And so you can see why there is the disconnect between the reality that we know to be truer to divinity, truer to our nature on every level and every dimension, and the one that we see in the, you know, in the news media, the political reality, and even in our own families. So what I call the myth of choice is that old world view, as I lovingly call it, that old world industrial age conditioning. It was literally called the classical mechanical worldview. Now, in other thinkers and, I would say, wisdom teachers in the early 20s, 30s, Uspensky, Gurdjieff, people like this who they called mechanical man, Wilhelm Reich, mechanical man. And I look at this and say, okay, mechanical worldview, in many ways, we became automatic in the way that we think, in the way that we relate to reality. When you look only in the physical, we look separate. We don't relate. When I'm saying we, in general, you're saying, well, you know, how does the world relate? There, you can understand why we have been living in separation, including separate, you know, like in this conceptual reality where the heart is only awakened, you know, on 20 minutes after 9/11 or something like that, and then it goes right back. And you wonder why we're in this either-or, liberal-conservative, masculine-feminine, all these splits that are not an aspect of nature, of our deepest nature. So the idea of quantum thinking is literally to make that leap, a literal quantum leap in consciousness, and start to look and live from the principles, which is, you know, the big paradigm shift, which I know you know, and I'm sure most of your audience, if not all, realize the big paradigm shift from the industrial age to the quantum age, from a science perspective, is the shift from a matter-based reality to a mind-based reality, a consciousness-based reality, a multidimensional reality, a both-and reality. So I look at it like this, Karen. Well, if it's a mind-based reality, then it's incumbent upon us as individuals and collectively to embody the principles of mind, I call the five natural faculties of mind, that enable us to create anything. Because if we want to create a reality where all of us are coming into that individual expression of our life purpose. And also I'm a serious student of astrology for many years, and I've heard, you know, you've had great astrologers that you have on the show, that, you know, when you look at this time period, that it is time, and I've heard you say it too, where it's time for us to connect to that next expression of our own identity. So this is the idea. It's a little bit long, but just to give the context of what quantum thinking is, the intent of it, the purpose of it, and most importantly, that it actually has it happen, because that's my purpose, is how do we go from knowing the wisdom to actually living it, to embodying it, to integrating it. So when you bring these principles into your awareness, you literally give yourself a visceral experience, and that is what creates the shift.
Well, it is. It's hard to wrap your mind around it. You know, because it's huge. It requires us to think in ways we've never thought before, to conceive of things we can't see, and then, you know, that sort of, you know, we get that you know, little voice in our head that goes, "Are you just delusional?" You know. You know, we talk about being interconnected, but do we really believe it? And even those of us who think we really believe it, do we act every day as if we really believe it? I don't know. I think maybe in a way that's kind of what you're talking about, isn't it?
Yes, and I think you're bringing up, you know, you honed in right on a very important point, which is, and first of all, I say in the beginning of Do You Quantum Think, maybe there's nothing wrong with us. You know, maybe don't we need a new spin on this? Because, you know, we know from what the work that you're doing and the people who you're allowing to have a voice in this way, that we can literally rewrite history. But, yes, you brought up the point about these, what's invisible to us. So if you just look at it, you know, in ordinary logic, that if we're brought up under this worldview where the whole orientation is around the physical, we're not relating, for example, to the fact that we exist in fields, even though all of our technology works that way. I mean, we have signs and signals of it all around us, including the ability to, you know, what gives us the ability to have a show like this. So when you look at, when you start, that's what I mean by taking the quantum leap, and you start to look from the principles rather than at them from your more, you know, older or undifferentiated view. Because when you start to realize that we exist in fields, what are these fields? It's a mind field. It's a field of energy informed by intelligence. It's a field of consciousness. It's a field of awareness. It's a field of love. It's a field of connectivity. Now, we know, and this is the beauty of the science, is that the quantum physicists are now proving, and it's been proven many times over, the effect mind-to-mind communications and the effect of mind on matter, quite literally. So when you realize, Karen, what you brought up, we are in fields together. So then you think, well, you know what? We are emanating, right? We are always communicating out, I call us simulcasting reality, right? Collectively. But individually and collectively, we're communicating out our state. Well, what is our state based on? Our habitual thoughts. You know, every wisdom tradition has said this, as you think, so you become. The Buddha, all that we are is a result of what we've thought. And, you know, we could name every single one, the Bible. And you, and then the modern wisdom teachers as well, who are teaching science of mind. So we know this. And as you said, we repeat, oh, we're all interconnected. But now this is distinguishing. Well, in what way are we interconnected? In this way. So that the reality that, you know, there is no fixed reality. The old worldview said it was fixed and solid objects, push and pull on something to get something to happen. And when you look at the quantum worldview, you realize, oh, everything is energy in flux. It's always shifting and changing. Well, what is the, you know, what is the factor, the element that's having anything become manifest? That's us, the observer, the human observer, what we hold in our own awareness, what we hold in consciousness on a habitual way is literally conditioning our state, conditioning our own resonance, what we're emanating. So if we are holding, let's look at this idea of the, so the point being, we are affecting the world, certainly the immediate people around us. You know, you can feel that. It's very simple. You walk into a room. You can feel whether there is an energy of happiness, exuberance, or, you know, uptightness. Was there a debate going on before you walked in? You can feel it. So we know that we are exchanging this energy intelligence all the time. Now, you look at this idea of how do we have the sacred feminine principle. And the sacred that principle expressed through women, especially, I would say, and men. But let's just look at women, that how do we have ourselves transcend this, you know, from what we have, let's say, in a developed industrialized country such as the United States or Great Britain, where we can see how, you know, women receiving less pay, or, you know, it's a little bit milder version, although we're seeing the backlash, you know, trying to take away women's reproductive rights and all that right now. But then you look at some of the developing countries where the marginalization of women is something horrendous. And I know that you bring up these things. So we look at it and we're saying, well, wait a minute. Well, how can a new way of thinking, which I like to think of as awakened thinking, awakened thinking. We can only be a choice when we are awakened beyond our automatic conditioning.
Diane, I think it's almost, let me just stop you for a minute, but before you get too much further along. The first thing I think I want to say is, you know, I think the only thing, the only aspect of that we have accepted as sort of like an invisible part of ourselves that we are sort of conditioned to accept as real is maybe the idea of a soul. I think anything beyond that sort of gets into like new agey or new agey woo-woo stuff or maybe scientific theories or study that makes the average person's eyes glaze over because it's really hard to comprehend it maybe on some level. But I'm trying to simplify this, you know, and sort of get a little bit more concise. And I don't know if this is an example of what you're talking about, but simple as this may sound, and feel free to laugh at me. It's okay if I'm totally off track. But I actually attended a spoon bending class once. And I think that was the thing that made the most impression on me, that we could actually affect things with our thoughts, because we literally were put through the paces to believe that we had generated enough heat in our body, and we were told to see that ball of heat come down our arm into our hand where we were holding a fork. And we could easily bend that fork now because the heat we had applied to that fork would now bend it. And we did. And we were just average people. And everybody in the circle was able to bend that fork. So in a way, is this kind of the quantum thinking, the idea that our thoughts can really manifest and create things? It's almost as if we need a pair of quantum glasses to not
right,
see,
exactly.
you know, to not really see our physical body anymore, but to see our body as an energy field. Because if we could see our body as an energy field, maybe then we could see how our thoughts emanate from our energy body and go out, and maybe how they mingle with, you know, your neighbor's energy body, or how the energy body of the United States maybe affects the energy body of Russia, kind of a thing. I mean, is this kind of what we're talking about, or
yes,
am I totally misunderstanding
you?
You
know, no, you've totally got it. And it's so funny that you brought up that thing about the spoon bending. I think I may have done that earlier too, but the reason it's funny, or what, as we call it in our business, the quantum occurrence, you know, that connection that Carl Jung talks about, right, synchronicity, that about a week ago I was on a teleconference call that was presented by a friend of mine, and he was presenting Uri Geller. And I don't know if you know who Uri Geller is.
Yeah.
He was the guy, he was, you know, like one of the most famous psychics who brought that, I think in the 1970s. The spoon bending guy, right? And I just heard him talking about it. But anyway, that was funny. So, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't laugh at that. And the thing about it, Karen, is it's not, this is the idea of making this leap, and why I wrote, you know, why I created the quantum thing, system of thinking, to say, you know, we know, you know, we have some knowledge. We know a little bit, you know, we know about meditation. We know about subtle energy. We know about, you know, energy healing or holistic healing, or, you know, all these little things that we're attuned into. But I think we never really saw it as a whole system, and we are in a, you know, a universe of whole systems. The supermarket is a system. The streets, you know, that we drive on are a system. So it's not, it's like once you see it, you leap systems literally in the way that you think, then it becomes natural because, yes, it sounds scientific. Quantum thinking is not about science. It's about how these discoveries shaped the way we think and how we can now shape the way we think because, you know, why should we? It's part one I write, wake up. Part one is wake up. And in essence, it's what's going on in the world, what has gone on, and why, you know, we're saying, oh, you should quantum think? Why? Well, when you look in the world and you realize that the pace of change is accelerating, and we're all experiencing this. I mean, it's like the years are just, we're in, you know, it's actually a scientific fact, but it's speeding by, and you can experience that. And then you see that, you know, every moment there's an increasing number of emails in your inbox. I mean, let's make this very practical and down to earth. Increasing level of choice and complexity. And then because we're in this transitional period for humanity where we have shifted, you know, from an industrial age way of living, way of being, that old either-or reality is shifting. And this is what we're seeing is some of the people, you know, hanging on to that old, well, what do you mean women are coming into their own power? You know, that kind of thing. So it's like, it's not that, I would say this is not an awakened choice. But when you look at these three things, the uncertainty because of the shifting age that we're in, the increasing number of choice and complexity, the acceleration of change, it can make your head spin. And, you know, people talk about stress and burnout. So what do we do? Well, that's why it's important to be thinking more in sync with the way that nature works, with what all the great wisdom traditions have known this.
Okay. But, okay, we probably have 15 minutes left. So I want to make the last 15 minutes really useful. So let's just assume we're all on the same page that, you know, we are energy bodies, we are multidimensional and all of that. I think the problem is we are so rooted in our physical world that it is really hard to keep thinking on this other non-physical level. You know, we keep being pulled back. We keep being pulled back into what's familiar, what, you know, just sort of the everyday physicality. So let's sort of cut to the chase. How do we quantum think? How do we keep ourselves more in the quantum thinking way of being and out of this physical body of separation where we don't feel, recognize, act on our interconnection?
Great. Okay, two things that we can use immediately, okay? One is that to know that the dynamic that we have been born with, divinely bestowed with, the ability to create, in a human sense, the power of intent. In the way that I use intent in quantum thinking, it's an activation of the field so that your own resonance, what you have your attention on that you're energizing, and where you keep your focus. Now, so let's just put that. Okay, the creation dynamic is your own intent, and that activates your energy intelligence, and you attract many results, not one like an end result intent, but more in the shamanic sense, where this is what you're holding your attention on. This is what you desire, and I want to apply it too, but now, what interferes with it, because you're bringing up the really good points, Karen, is what I call least action pathways, least-action as one word, least action pathways, the way the energy or the thought goes, because it's been that route before, the route of the least creative, least awakened awareness, the most mechanical thought. Now, there are least action pathways that are individual, least action pathways that are of the culture, least action pathways of gender. So here's it would be an example. The more that what we focus on, we energize. And what we energize, we expand. We add mass to. That becomes the reality. So if you want to know how to change the reality, you create your intent for what you want. The intent is said in a present moment, a present tense, and you live from that as a context, not because it's based in evidence, because reality is context dependent. This is a quantum principle. So I'm just trying to say it fast. So the intent might be stated like this. We are delighted in the way that women are being recognized, valued, and expressing ourselves in the world. And we're delighted with the way that's unfolding. So whether it is, and then when you go into, yes, but, okay, that's what I mean by the least action pathways. Because those thoughts could come up, Karen, where you're saying, yes, but, you know, the patriarchal paradigm is still predominant. Now, if you hold that view, even though there could be evidence for it, you know, I say it like this, old worldview, circumstance rules, new worldview, intent rules. That's how I say it to the kids. They get it right away because we're the ones beginning now shaping what is going on now and into the future. So this is where you have to almost fool your senses, because when you realize the dynamics of mind are actually creating, what we focus on expands.
So in other words, let me try to be succinct. We have to stop talking about the damage patriarchy has done and actually start speaking as if what we want to accomplish is already here, that we that, you know, women are powerful, women have equality, we have peace in the world, whatever it is, we have equality, there's no more income disparity, that sort of thing. We have to focus on that as if it is a reality, sort of like when an athlete does visualizations and they see themselves crossing the finish line. We have to see it happening rather than continuing to talk about how we got here or the things that thwart us.
That's exactly right. And the only thing I would say is, you said, well, there's no more income inequality. Now, that is a kind of thing where we can't fool our minds very well with that, but it's more like to come up with what we can hold. And what we can hold is that we're happy about the way the feminine principle is unfolding right now. We're happy about our strength. We're happy about we're happy about that we're expressing ourselves fully, and that we're fully in the power of the sacred feminine. You know,
but Diane, you know what worries me about this? What worries me about this, and please talk me down from this, okay?
I will.
What worries me about doing this kind of thing is, it almost feels as if then we are I can see the value of what you're talking about. Don't get me wrong. And maybe it's just that I don't fully understand this and we don't really have enough time to cover it thoroughly. But if we just focus the way you're talking about, I feel like that sort of takes all of our energy away from maybe I see I'm a social justice activist, and politics concern me, and, you know, how Republicans are doing all of this crazy shit around the country that, you know, it hurts everybody but the 1%. You know, that bothers me, and it almost feels like you know, what you're saying is don't focus on that. You know, don't give that energy. And I've been told that before, don't give that energy. But I feel like if we don't give that energy, if we don't fight the things that are dangerous to us, and it's almost as if we're insulating ourselves in what we hope tomorrow will be, but how will tomorrow ever be better if we don't obliterate the dangerous forces first?
Okay, I'm so happy you brought this up. First of all, I'm just about to becoming a blogger on HuffPost, and I'm working out like how to get this thinking into politics because I'm very interested in that myself and see the importance of it. So let me just say one thing and then go deeper into it a little bit, addressing what you said. First of all, this quantum thinking is not positive thinking. Positive thinking is having a positive affirmation, oh, everything is beautiful, on top of a negative belief. Now, the most important fundamental quantum worldview principle is that there are no absolutes other than what you think of as God, divine, that source creator. I'm talking about in everyday human reality. Nothing is fixed and solid. There are no absolutes. Great. Then what creates reality? The context that we choose to live from. Why? Because context shapes the field. Context creates the resonance, and that does have an effect. That's real. That's been proven, and we're just starting to grasp this. So now let's look at what you just said. The fact is that I gave a talk on this at the Enneagram, International Enneagram, when I was a keynote a few years ago, which I called the end of the great divide. And here's the paradox of a quantum reality, is that as long as we think there's an us and a them, we're holding that in place. Now, this is really challenging because you said it. It's like we're looking at it and we're seeing, but they are doing that, but they are redistricting, but they are trying to block people from voting, but they are putting, you know, the top five billionaires on the Republican, you know, conservative side are putting their money in and trying to obliterate through. Yes. However, it is true. What we focus on expands. So until we actually, you know, we want to live the wisdom, compassion, love, kindness, connection, all of that coming from the state of joy, it is challenging, Karen. There's no question about it. To say that, are we really one? Is it a unity consciousness? Are we really living that? Then we hold them. You know, people have said to my husband, Alan Collins, is my partner, and we've been delivering quantum things for years, although my book came out more recently. Now, and, you know, people get it because it strikes what's universal chord, and they get it. They have the awakening, and they even say it's awakening. And, you know, they are in these corporate environments. They are the senior executives. We have worked in federal agencies of the United States government because you have to start seeing them as people. So what I call the end of the great divide, and where I, you know, call on what I call lovingly and one of the consciousness crowd, is that it's up to us to just have what we know as the reality, as the reality. So, I mean, when I say as the reality, I'm talking about this more enlightened, more loving world view. And that when we just act as if this is the reality, collectively, that's going to emanate. But Karen, the more we fight against, you look at war, it's never worked. So it has to be, I feel, a transcendence of the either or, us against them. We have to fight the evil. I actually, you know, look at this. It's maybe way far out to even imagine. But what if we could imagine, and, you know, the philosopher, I was a philosophy major in college, Nietzsche had a book, you know, The Good Beyond Good and Evil. It's something like that. It's that, not that we're Pollyannas or that, you know, it's New Agey BS, but that at some point we have to realize, oh, this is the way we are generating what's going on in the world, what the future is unfolding. It's up to us to make that shift. Is this making sense to you?
Kinda. I'm still not totally grasping how I just sort of disassociate from, let's just call it, the evils out there, to try to put my energy maybe into the things that are working more positively so that they will expand rather than fighting the evil so that, you know, I'm not putting my energy there so that that expands. It almost feels negligent to...
No, because you're saying dissociate. Like, I'm not saying ignore it. I'm not saying dissociate from it. I'm saying find a way to have it work, given that that's what's going on. Oh, I was going to tell you, when we worked in these places, right, and people would say, well, they'll, you know, even some of the leaders, they'd say to us, well, you know, I get what you're saying, you know, quantum thinking and the principles, which, by the way, it's a system of 21 specific principles and practices that put this all together. But the point is that they go, I get it, but I don't think the other people are going to. And you see, this is what, or, you know, how do you get this across? Because we hold the intent. Is it the truth? There is no actual truth. There's just what we focus on. The context, it's like a bad hair day, a good hair day, the glass half empty, the glass half full. We're choosing to live from that this is what people want. People want things to work. And you, what you do is, it's then it becomes, I would say, the opposite of what you think I'm saying. You don't, it's not negligible, you know, you don't dissociate or ignore it. You actually get more involved in it because the creativity comes, Karen, in, and we stand in the question, how can we have this work for everyone? And what happens is when you stand in that kind of a question and you can distinguish what is actually going on, all of these ills, or what we could sum up as, you know, that evil, you know, that horrible, you know, side that's being expressed, because it is an infinite possibility world. We all have every possible human trait can manifest. The question is, what is having it manifest? So what we can look at, oh, this is what's manifesting now. Look at it in a larger perspective. It's not to ignore it. It's to look at and see what kind of conversations can we create that actually have people see a new perspective, another point of view, one that works for them and us. So if you take the oil companies or the food manufacturing, the big problem with, you know, this whole health vicious cycle, you know, we're not treating the soil properly. We're putting all these additives in that are making people sick, and then we end up with a health crisis, and then we have a big fight over should we have health care or not, you know, all that thing, because we have to start having source conversations with people rather than saying the corporate, you know, the billionaires are the bad guys, the corporations are the bad guys, the Republicans are the bad guys. It's that we have to start seeing that from the perspective of all perspectives and saying, okay, if they're fearing their loss of profit, if they're fearing, like, what are they going to do if they're not drilling for oil anymore, you know, and start to have intelligent conversations, people like you who is, you know, so scholarly and so worldly and, you know, just so has such a broad base of knowledge. Now, how do we express ourselves? I'm talking about myself and everyone listening. How can we create new conversations so that we're actually connecting with these people rather than trying to obliterate them?
Right. Well, Diane, we are just about out of time here, and I feel like we only probably touched the tip of the iceberg, you know. We this is a lot deeper conversation. So why don't you tell listeners where they can find your website, where they can get your book, because I feel like this is an important subject. You know, we need to be able to do what you're talking about for us to maybe make that next leap. And I think we all, you know, more of us have to be able to get this and figure out how to do it in everyday life. So help us by sending us to your website or where we can get your book.
Okay, great. Well, my website is Diane Collins, and it's Diane with two N's, DianneCollins.com. And my book is, well, first of all, when you go on my website, when you sign, you can sign up for my mailing list, and I'm going to be announcing certain things about, you know, my HuffPost blog and things. But when you do sign up, you get an article that makes this very, very simple, and the title of the article is "You Can't Get There From Here," and why change doesn't work. So it's like distinguishing what I'm talking about and very simple with examples. The other thing is that you can, of course, I wrote a book so that everyone would read it and use it. It's not a one-time read. It's I know you have the book. It's something that you use for life. I call it a friend for life. We read it all the time because you have to keep, you know, indulging.
Reinforcing it. Yeah.
And it is made, the intent is to connect to your own awareness as you read so that these principles become activated in you.
Right.
And it's Do You Quantum Think? New Thinking That Will Rock Your World. It's available on all the online, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, and in stores. And if it's not your local bookstore, you can order it. So that's anywhere in the world. Now,
okay.
And it's in hardcover and it's in ebook. But I just wanted to offer your listeners one other thing, that if you want to contact me, you know, by going on my website, the contact is there, and my email is there, because I have an article, if you want to get this a little bit deeper. My other article is great. It's very simple and practical. It shows you how to apply it to your business. But this other article I wrote, which is hidden, so I have to send you the link, which is Thinking Not As Usual. New thought is not new age anymore. Just what you were talking about, Karen, and I would be happy to send you the link to that article if you contact me on DianneCollins.com. And it really goes in a little bit deeper of, you know, what this whole paradigm shift is and a few quotes from it. Makes it very simple, you know, how we can think in a new way to come up with a really solution-based world.
Okay. Well, Diane, I'm sorry I have to wrap it up now.
I know.
But this is important, and thank you for pointing out those articles. And I will probably be emailing you tomorrow to get that link myself, because I do really want to wrap my mind around this, because I feel like I'm sort of beating my head against a brick wall sometimes, and, you know, we just aren't making enough progress. You know, it feels like we, you know, and some days it feels like we're being steamrolled, you know, rather than making progress. So
I know, and this is why you're so, I appreciate what you're saying so much. It really is important.
Okay.
So thank you so much for having me. I know you want to give your what's your next section? I like
Yeah, I have to get to why capitalism is a dirty word.
Oh, yes, that's right. Okay, we'll go for it. I'm going to keep listening, too. So
all right.
Write to me tomorrow, and I'll send you the link.
All right. Thank you, Diane. I really appreciate it. Good
Thank
night.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay, listeners, we have just a few minutes left, but I think we have enough time to do this. And this comes from Op-Ed News, and as I promised, it's the article by Carl Gibson called Let's Make Capitalism a Dirty Word. And the caption under the picture is, Americans have literally become slaves to capitalism. And it starts like this. Immediately upon entering adulthood, Americans are forced to compete for increasingly scarce employment. The purpose of most employment isn't to create value for society or future generations, but to create profits for a scant few executives and shareholders. In order to be competitive enough to gain employment, Americans are expected to take on so much debt for a higher education that most of the income gained in their adult years will be spent paying off that debt. In return for all their hard work, Americans who aren't executives or shareholders are paid just enough to meet basic needs like food, clothing, and shelter, some of us anyway. And under the capitalist system, the majority of life for today's average American before retirement is spent pursuing profits that will never be shared with them. And because capitalists like Pete Peters and the Koch brothers are so determined to weaken Social Security in the pursuit of ever-increasing profits, even retirement is unstable. As a system predicated on the need to grow endlessly and never stagnate, capitalism is doomed to fail. I've written previously on this site about how capitalism is currently in its end game, similar to the end game of Monopoly, where one player has accumulated nearly all the property and money, and all the other players are afraid to make any moves at all, lest they land on the wrong square and are destroyed by debt. Capitalism is succeeding exactly like it's supposed to. All the resources and wealth are concentrating into fewer and fewer hands, and corporate profits are hitting record highs every quarter. The Dow Jones and S&P 500 are doing better than they've done in decades. Worker productivity and gross domestic product has increased at a rapid pace, yet wages are stagnant. As a direct result of the rise of corporate dominance of government, the profit motive has become the primary motive of operation, not just for private business, but for government institutions. One example is the Department of Education booking $41.3 billion in profits off student loans, even though the student loan bubble has surpassed the $1 trillion mark. Groups like the American Legislative Exchange Council allow capitalists to write laws behind closed doors, then wine and dine state lawmakers to pass those laws in exchange for future campaign contributions from capitalists. Election laws are now set to benefit capitalists who can anonymously donate millions of dollars to a super PAC and dominate public airwaves with false advertising, while grassroots candidates without millions on their side are shut out of the public conversation. Capitalists like General Electric, Citigroup, and Monsanto can write legislation with members of Congress that stack the deck in their favor while overseeing that legislation's passage. Capitalists who own mercenary companies can get paid billions of dollars in defense contracts while pay and benefits for veterans are cut from the budget. Capitalists like Koch brothers can escape accountability through foreign subsidies despite violating U.S. trade laws, and banks like J.P. Morgan Chase can escape jail time despite frauding millions of homeowners. But homeless people like Gregory Taylor are sentenced to 25 years in jail for stealing bread. During the Cold War era, if people didn't openly embrace capitalism, they ran the risk of being called a communist sympathizer and intimidated out of their job. But the tables are turning on capitalism as more and more people become aware of the consequences of capitalism. In November 2011, during the height of the Occupy Wall Street movement, conservative messaging specialist Frank Luntz had a meeting with the Republican Governors Association to teach them how to address the growing populist energy sweeping the country. Quote, Luntz, he said, I'm so scared of this anti-Wall Street effort. I'm frightened to death. They're having an impact on what the American people think of capitalism, unquote. Luntz's first suggestion to the Republican governors was to stop saying the word capitalism, as it was believed by many in the country to be immoral, according to Luntz. The Occupy movement was seen as a failure because it focused too heavily on critiquing capitalism rather than uniting around a proposed alternative to capitalism or creating viable solutions. But ironically, the nationally coordinated crackdown on the Occupy movement was one of the best things to happen to the movement. It dispersed thousands of newly trained radical organizers from city parks into cities. Fast food worker strikes have been organized in over 100 cities. Occupy Wall Street's strike debt project abolished $14.7 million in distressed medical debt and outpaced FEMA in disaster relief during Hurricane Sandy. The Occupy movement has gone from occupying city parks to building homes for the homeless, occupying foreclosed homes, and occupying city halls not as protesters but as elected officials. Rather than merely critiquing capitalism, the movement is actively contradicting and creating alternatives to it. What will come after capitalism is uncertain, but what is certain is that there is more than enough wealth in the world to provide basic needs like food, clothing, and shelter to all people. And might I also add education and health care, please, to that? Okay, that was my 2 cents. Going on to the article, a United Nations study estimated that to end global poverty, provide basic health care and education, combat disease like HIV and malaria, create environmental stability, improve maternal health, address the gap in gender equality, and reduce child mortality, developed nations would have to contribute to just 0.7% of their gross national income over a 10-year period. For the United States, that would cost just $90 billion per year. That amounts to just 8.7% of our current military budget. Despite such an obvious and easy solution, we all know we currently don't have the political leadership to accomplish this and likely won't anytime soon if we depend solely on the Democratic and Republican parties. A new populist, explicitly anti-capitalist party must emerge and start organizing at the grassroots level to build power over time. And this new political party must be led by and represent the young, the unemployed, the underemployed, and the misemployed, people of color, people in debt, and everyone else who has been victimized by capitalism, and let me say women who are making only 77 cents on the dollar. Okay, so if you want a copy of that article, you can find it at the opednews.com, opednews.com. It's called Let's Make Capitalism a Dirty Word. So, as we come to the close of the show tonight, I want to thank everyone for tuning in. And I'd like to close with what has become the favorite closing of my regulars. And it goes like this. Adversaries of the sacred feminine try to sweep away awareness and knowledge of her for all time. And with that sweeping away, when the great she was made to disappear because of the religion of patriarchy, of selfish and disconnected men and their war gods, women and their power, their leadership, their spiritual authority were thwarted, repressed, became taboo, diminished, and disrespected. That's why here on the show, I am dedicated to recovering the great she, whether she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and I know you all are too. Yes, we intend to defy, to taste the forbidden fruit, to be powerful and uppity women and men, to throw off the shackles, look under every rock, behind every locked door, peer into the abyss of the past so we know why things are the way they are, how they have come to be so turned on their head and so unnatural. And we're going about setting things right. Why? Because if we want to save ourselves and Mother Earth, our beloved Gaia, then we have no other choice. If we want to live in a world of balance, harmony, wholeness, sanity, equity, fairness, and partnership, it is women and our like-minded brothers armed with ideals of the sacred feminine who will set things back on track. And let me once again repeat what have become a couple of the mottos of the show. There are three. The first is by the German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer. He said, "All truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it is accepted for being self-evident." Gandhi said, "First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win." And finally, the third quote from Monique Wittig, there was a time when you were not a slave. Remember that. You walked alone, full of laughter. You bathed bare-bellied. You say you have lost all recollection of it. Remember. You say there were no words to describe this time. You say it does not exist. Remember. Make an effort to remember, or failing that, invent. Yes, indeed, failing that, invent. Remember, listeners, we are the cognitive minority. We're just waiting for everyone else to catch up. So thank you very much for tuning into the show. I will be with you again next Wednesday, as I am every Wednesday. And I will close the show tonight with this cut by Abigail Spinner McBride, In the Arms of the Mother. And until next week, may the great she embrace you in her golden wings. Good night.